Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to North and South Podcasts. Something a bit new for you this week. I'm going to review one of my favourite films, which is a film called Excalibur from 1981. You may have seen it, you probably haven't, although it's a film that has been very influential. And although it was technically American produced, it was filmed in Ireland by the British director John Borman. And it's based on Arthurian legend. Now, it's been considered the best film ever made about the Arthurian legend, and I would be inclined to agree with that. And although it was made in 1981, the visual effects in it, by effects, I'm not talking special effects, but what you see on screen is remarkable. It's very much a visual piece. And it's loosely based on Malory's La Mort d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur, which was written in the late Middle Ages. And obviously there's a very inconsistent historical basis to the whole idea of Arthurian legend, but it's based on the idea of chivalry and great stories, those kind of like Jungian archetypes going back, and those kind of like memes which are passed on from one society and one tradition and one generation to another. But John Borman is quite a famous director. He's made some great films, and I consider some of the films he's made to be the best I've ever seen, including Deliverance, which is the one about the city guys who go canoeing in rural America and then things start going wrong for them. It's got that classic banjo scene in. But that's a great film as well, and you should check out other John Borman films. John Borman said about Excalibur when it was made that it was based on the idea of mythical truth, not historical truth. So there's a transcendence to it, all of this kind of legendary greatness, mystique, myth, which is central to the whole film. The screenplay was adapted by, I think it was Roscoe Pallenberg, and he put together a fantastic script which took Malory's original writing and turned it into a film piece, as it were. Interestingly enough, the people behind the film who funded it, wanted Borman to make Lord of the Rings. And you can actually see in some of the characters and some of the things in Excalibur that there's ideas he's used from Lord of the Rings. So there's like orc-like figures in the final battle at the end, if you look closely. It's a very dark film, and by dark I don't just mean like it looks at the dark side of human nature, which it does. It's very much a film about good and evil. But I remember my sister and I were a bit shocked by the adult content when we watched it at the end of the 1980s. I think it was on Channel 4, and back in the day, before all the streaming, etc., used to get really quirky films on like BBC Two, Channel 4, sometimes at the weekends, Friday night. And I remember watching a great film on ITV many years ago, and I only saw it once and then never really saw it again, called The Fruit Machine, which was about a couple of gay lads from Liverpool who go down to Brighton. And used to catch things like that, because there was only four channels to watch. But anyway, Excalibur was on, and it was about like the myth of Arthur and the sword from the stone. And I think I saw an advert for it. And I recorded it on a VCR tape. So me and my sister watched it a few times, and then I watched it. I've probably seen it about 30, 40 times. It's still dark now, both literally and metaphorically. Darkness and light are a big theme throughout the film. And it ties in with the good and evil kind of key theme of the film as well. And it's used very, very effectively. And there's a lot of stuff in it which is quite dark, like human betrayal, etc. All the great tragedies of human behaviour, etc. But it is filmed in rural Ireland, and it's beautifully shot. Beautifully shot. Yeah, lots of scenes of nature, fog, and again, the use of light and darkness. One of the more remarkable aspects of it is the kind of what Francis Bacon said about being an assault on the senses is is the use of music. It's got a great original score by Terry Jones, but there's a few really beautiful classical pieces of music, including Wagner's Siegfried's Funeral March from Götterdämmerung, which is a beautiful piece of music. And something quite mad happened with that piece of music many years later, which I might tell you another time, but it's a piece of music that is quite close to my heart because of Excalibur. It's got a great cast. There's some very famous names there, including people who became famous after they were in the film. So Liam Neeson, Gabriel Byrne, Kieran Hines, people like that are in it. And they later became big household names. But also the ones who didn't become so famous afterwards put in absolutely superb performances. The acting is top draw, not least from Merlin, the magician, the sorcerer, who's played by Nicole Williamson. Fantastically, he's the glue that keeps the whole film together right through across some of the different generations. It was given a lot of credit for its use of armour and the visual style and got awards for it. But at the time, Excalibur was much criticised because of its plot and its characterisations, because it kind of moves along at quite a quick pace. And to get La Mort d'Arthur, an Arthurian legend, in a 3-hour film is difficult enough. But it was then reduced to about 2 hours 15. And there are things in it sometimes where you think that it doesn't flow as well as it might. And this is another thing that I've seen in the film Dune by David Lynch, the original Dune, where you originally had 9 hours, and when you watch it, you can tell big bits have been missed out. And you think, oh, something needed to happen there to develop, kind of thing. But with me, I think Excalibur stands the test of time and is a cult classic, a bit like Dune is becoming a cult classic as well, despite some of its limitations. Some critics were not very impressed, though, with the plot and the characters, but I think that's very, very harsh. It did do well at the box office. Rotten Tomatoes gives it 73%. Metacritic gives it 56%, but again, that's a bit harsh. That's based on a few critics online. And it is very much a film that grows over time, and great films do. I mean, there's this idea, isn't there? There's so many films out there. You watch a film once and then, you know. But there are certain films which I go back to and I can put on and I can watch. And certain lines are almost like quite spiritual, religious, and Excalibur very much is one of those films for me. Another theme in the film Excalibur is the idea of the old pagan religion kind of embodied by Merlin, and then the kind of grail quest towards the end where Percival finds the grail, the Holy Grail. And that shows how the new religion ascends, and ultimately that's what galvanizes the kingdom of Arthur towards the end of the film, when the king and the land are reunited as one again. That kind of idea of we're all in it together mentality, which is still a big part of modern political culture in some approaches and in some ideologies. But that's not something that you kind of get on your first watch, but it is something I believe John Borman has acknowledged, that he was trying to show how the old religion was replaced with the new. Neeson said it was a very rich film, and I think that's a great way of describing it. Liam Neeson said that, and he learned a lot from Borman about directing. And Neeson was a stage actor, and he very much learned the art of acting for films and how it comes across in the camera. And that pushed him on to other things. It starts off during the reign of Uther Pendragon, who's Arthur's father. And he's played superbly by Gabriel Byrne. And Merlin and Uther come together. Uther gains the sword Excalibur, the sword of kings, which impresses everyone and is meant to unite the kingdom. And it fails to unite the kingdom because of human nature. Arthur is then born, and Merlin takes Arthur away from this kind of illegitimate birth and takes him and gives him to someone to look after him and to bring him up. And then it jumps forward in time. Arthur is the squire to his brother, who's the knight of the family, and then he becomes king ultimately, gains Excalibur. He settles the rebellion against him through his intelligence and his kind of decision making in the moment, and even Merlin is impressed by his decision making. And he goes very much from a young squire to a man overnight, as it were, through the responsibility of the kingdom. Another big part of the film is how Lancelot is then incorporated into the Knights of the Round Table, the building of Camelot, the mythical palace of Arthur. And music is just used beautifully throughout the battle scenes. There's a few pitched throughout the film, different types of fighting scenes, which are very memorable in terms of art, not necessarily graphic depiction, but it's trying to capture that mythical idea of, you know, the old ways of brave people fighting against their enemies and face to face, that kind of chivalry and honor, etc. There's a great quote halfway through the film by Guinevere, who's played by Sherry Lungi, and she says, when she's accused of having affections for Lancelot, and I quote, "In the idleness that comes with peace, I see that gossip has bred its own evil." And that quote at the time didn't really leave an impression with me, but it kind of accounts for the psychological belief, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that when we have our needs met, we start focusing on the next thing, and then when they're met, the next thing, that kind of belief, which I think has a lot of strength. And because the kingdom is united and there's peace all over the kingdom, the enemies of Arthur were defeated in battle. Accusations are made against Sherry Lungi's Guinevere by Morgana, who's played by Helen Mirren and Liam Neeson's Knight. So fracture then happens across the kingdom, and it's very much a theme, isn't it? The idea of, like, you know, Brexit, and in some of the bigger nations you often get regression. So the development of populism, where the results are not very impressive, if even remotely progressive in any way, shape or form. But people in their idleness turn to things because they want to make things better, or they're unhappy with the current situation, even though the current situation might be one of peace and expanding wealth, etc. But again, there's lots of cans of worms I could open there. But the idea that when there's peace and idleness, evil finds a way, that often human nature, even in good times, you'll get fracture and division, and people turn towards ideas which might not be considered the most enlightened. But I thought that was good as well, the way that that was placed in the film. After this, the land becomes fractured, and, you know, it's almost a political theme, like one nation conservatism from Disraeli, the idea that there's the hierarchies of society, but the people at the top are paternalistic to those at the bottom. This idea that we're all united under one leader, it's kind of a noble idea, and certainly one that is long gone, if it ever existed. The Grail quest forms a big part of the film as well, where the Knights of the Round Table are challenged with finding the Grail to restore the kingdom, because the kingdom is unwell and Arthur is unwell. And without giving too much away about the ins and outs of the plot, the death of Arthur towards the end, who's played superbly by Nigel Terry, towards the end, the character of Mordred is introduced, who wears a special golden armour, and he's played superbly by the late Robert Addy. And it's one of the most powerful visuals of the film, this kind of golden armour from this pretender to be King Mordred, who then fights Arthur in battle late on in the film. And it's a very striking visual, and it kind of, as Merlin disappears from the plot, it's like Mordred comes in as this counterbalance of this idea of a dark leader taking over the kingdom in the future under his mother Morgana. But I won't give too much away about what happens towards the end, but that golden arm is a very powerful visual of the film, and it features on the cover of one of the DVD issues, I think the 2011 issue. I've been trying to get hold of the two documentaries about Excalibur, but they're very hard to source online and through DVD or Blu-ray format. The end scene is absolutely beautiful. I went to a festival a few years ago, and people were talking about great scenes from films, and I remember listening to it, and I thought to myself, if I could pick a great scene from a film, if I could choose one scene, it'd be after the final battle in Excalibur, where Percival and Arthur's mortally wounded, and he says to Percival, go and find a pool of water and throw the sword into the water. And Percival goes, no, I'm not doing that. And he says, do it. So Percival goes with no intention of doing it. And then he comes back and Arthur says, listen, one day a king will come and the sword will rise again. And the sword was given to the men of the kingdom by the Lady of the Lake, who represents like nature, etc. And she appears with her arm out of the lake. So Percival goes back to this lake and Wagner's funeral march comes on. So anyway, he throws the sword in and the arm has appeared and the arm gathers the sword. And there's this beautiful picturesque scene with the setting sun in the background. And Wagner's music reaches its height. And then the Lady of the Lake takes the sword down into the lake. And Percival like looks at it, holds his head back, still wearing his battle armour covered in blood, and realises he's seen something spectacular. For me, the way that Percival acts that, it's a Paul Jeffrey, the way he acts that, the visuals, the music, the mythical ending, I think is one of the greatest endings to a film that I've ever seen, and it really resonates with me. So much so that when I was researching for this podcast, I put on the film and watched the first 20 minutes and then watched the end scene just to refamiliarise myself with it. But for me, it's almost like a religious thing that the actors, like when I research it online, it's quite emotional for me finding out that some of the actors have died and how some of them never really went on to become actors in other films, etc. So it's quite an interesting film for me because it resonates so much. And you can see how kind of religions develop through people finding meaning from things that they find and they don't know the full story behind it. And then over time it changes. It's like the power of religion and belief in myth, etc. And I think it also can be linked to the idea of, you know, when people develop obsessions with things, and part of the religious idea is the idea of a belief that if you believe in something strongly enough, it takes on a greater meaning. And I think the great film does that as well, through the use of music, acting, words, etc. I don't think I explained that last point too well, and I lost my train of thought, but the film Excalibur 1981, it may seem a bit dated now to some of you, and one of the things I don't always like is when people make out that a film is amazing because they know it like the back of their hand. But then to the new novel viewer, it might not mean as much to them on the first viewing, if at all. So it's quite a subjective thing to talk about. The other thing I wanted to say, sorry, is that like I know all the words and the lyrics and the music, etc., to the film. So that's where like it takes on that kind of sacred thing for me, like almost a religious thing. So sometimes I put on the last scene from The Dark Knight where Batman takes the blame for the death of Harvey Dent and says, I'm willing to be the villain to keep Gotham united. And then he goes away and the music kind of builds up and Commissioner Gordon delivers a few words about Batman calling him the Dark Knight. The choice of words and the way that the film ends, it's not something you should watch once, it's something that demands to be watched many times. And I'll be perfectly honest, I watched that film at the pictures in 2008 and didn't get it. Went over my head. I almost said, not into that film. It was only when I watched it the second or third time that some of those deeper kind of appreciations started to emerge, became more rewarding. And I think that is one of the signs of great films, but it's also one of the great sadnesses that there's so many films that you might see that you were in the wrong frame of mind or you never see or whatever, that you don't get to get that from. But you can say that about life, about anything that you do throughout your life. You'll do certain things, you won't do certain things. Certain things won't even enter your head. And I think what film does is it provides us with an escape, the chance to tell a great story and a chance to immerse yourself in something that says a lot about the human condition, but also about the ideal. So I think that's where the religious elements of film and the spiritual elements of film come into the play. It's a similar kind of thing for me as what established religion might be for others. Right, that's my lowdown on the film Excalibur and my hyper-analytical nonsense. So I hope you enjoyed that. Please, if you can, for the price of a cup of coffee once a month. You can contribute on coffee.com for £3 a month. It really helps me. Follow me on Twitter at North Podcasts. Also, if you can like, subscribe and share on Spotify and YouTube, spread the word. Watch Excalibur, tell me what you think, and maybe tell me about your favourite films and why they're good to you, for you, if you want to come on and talk about it. Also music as well, music, film, anything cultural. I'm interested in talking about those kind of things as well. Thank you very much for your time. Look after yourselves, and don't forget, always find time to watch great films, read great books, listen to great music, and just do great things, people, because this is not a rehearsal. Take it easy.